I am co-owner of Digest Publishing, Nick Hodge, not here with my usual partner, Gerardo Del Real, who is the other co-owner of Digest Publishing and Resource Doc Digest. Instead, I am here with Mr. Christopher Curl, who runs Crypto Cycle for us and has done a hell of a job doing so. We gave him $50,000 of real money, as some of you may know, and he's been running a portfolio. And we've got Bitcoin back with a six-figure handle, so thought it was appropriate to have him back on. Chris, how you doing? I don't know if Chris can hear me. I'll stall until he gets back. Mr. Del Real is with his family in Pennsylvania. He's got a son who's graduating from college. Those 4 years went very fast. And so that's why we've got Chris filling in addition to the $100,000 Bitcoin. I'll start talking about the macro markets. We've got gold. Let's start there. Ran to $3,400 a couple of weeks ago and essentially got overbought and sold off here in the past 3 or 4 days. We had a $100 down day on Monday that took gold right to short-term support, right around the $3,200, just below that, in fact, 31 and change. It's bounced back from that nicely, was back above $3,200 today. And the stock sort of got whipsawed a bit. Even the large producers, the Agnicos, the Newmonts, the Kinrosses, et cetera, were having 10, 15% down days. A company we follow, they have followed for a long time, Perpetual Resources, was down, I think, 15 or 20% in one day and then bounced back. But gold is looking okay now. The other thing that's happened is that the S&P has continued to bounce back. We've had a bit of reprieve from all the tariff talk, thank goodness. But I'm not sure we've got a reprieve from the entire tariff situation. What we've got is a short-term agreement with China to delay the implementation of the tariffs. And then Trump went on his road trip here, and he's been in the Middle East and other states negotiating huge, big, wonderful deals that have sent the technology space back up and have caused a little bit of rotation in the S&P as it approaches back to the $6,000 level. The other thing that's happened is that bond yields have gone up precipitously in the past week as that trade deal was, I don't want to say negotiated because it was really just punted, but you have the 10-year yield back up to where it was a couple of weeks ago when we had consternation in the bond market and really things going haywire where the bond vigilantes were stepping in and sending the bond yields up. That's sort of the macro picture. We'll see where that ends up. Trump obviously wants those rates to turn around. Scott Bessent is likely not happy with the ascension of the 10-year yield in the past week here, and they obviously want a weaker dollar as well. So once Trump gets back from his the Middle Eastern tour, from his foreign road trip, I think we'll probably get back to this tariff talk, and we'll see what the Fed is going to do at their next meeting. No rate cuts in May, as many people anticipated, but still being priced in for the latter half of the year. And as I continue to stall just a little bit, maybe Chris can nod if he can hear me and is back on track. I'll talk about the CPI, which continued to soften down around 2.3-2.4%, and likely in a trough here, right? Because oil prices had been soft and are likely bottoming out, and I think you see it. Sorry for the technical difficulties today, y'all. But I think in the second half of the year, we get back to higher inflation, ticking back towards 3%, and then having growth go back up as well from a negative 0.3% in the first quarter of the year to higher growth in the second half. Maybe I just do it by myself. I'm not sure if it's worth having him pop in and out on the delay, but I can talk about Bitcoin a little bit for him until we get this sorted out, or until I have to change topics and go on by myself. What happened with Bitcoin is, as some of you may know, it dipped all the way down to 70,000 and change earlier in the year. I was bullish on it at that price. I had, in fact, issued a buy alert for Bitcoin ETFs at a certain price that they didn't quite get to. So I missed my opportunity to get into Bitcoin, but at least in foundational profits. But Chris has had his readers in Crypto Cycle, in Bitcoin for a while, in Ethereum for a while, and in several other altcoins that he's done well on. And over the past couple of weeks, it's just bounced. I mean, from that $73,000, $74,000, $75,000 level, all the way back up to $105,000 recently. I think it's trading around $102,000 today. I was going to ask Chris, you know, basically why? Why did it go up so fast from that $70,000+ level? Because typically, what happens with Bitcoin is one, it's a risk on asset, but two, it likes to go up with the monetary supply and the stimulus and with rate cuts. And we haven't really got that. I mean, we haven't had, you know, major stimulus since COVID, and then we certainly didn't get a rate cut in May. So that was going to be my question to Chris. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you, Nick. Sorry about the technical difficulties there. I was getting a lot of echo. But yeah, so if you rewind the tape and go back 2 months to when I was on Bizarro World during kind of the height of the tariff terror, as I called it, when Trump was unleashing the tariffs on the markets, I said that, hey, look, like this is pretty standard for Bitcoin. It does have 20 to 30% corrections, even in bull markets. And it filled the CME gap at around $77,000. The S&P 500 also had a similar gap that was filled. Both of those were set after the election of Donald Trump, really sent the market soaring. It was a really good risk-on environment. So, you know, it's not surprising to see those CME gaps get filled. That generally tends to happen with those. And as I was saying at the time, this is a buying opportunity. It might hit down to that $73,000 support level, but it didn't quite hit that, which is why I was saying, hey, if it's under $80,000, buy up Bitcoin. This is kind of a no-brainer because the bull market was not over. And it was interesting. I may have been the only person that I'm aware of that was calling for an actual continuation of the bull market. Because everyone as far that I was following had pretty much given up and people were turning bearish. They were selling off their altcoin portfolios. And I was saying, hey, listen, this happens during bull markets. And it reminded me in many ways of what happened in the summer of 2021 when Bitcoin surged up to about $64,000 and then just absolutely collapsed down to sub $30,000. About $32,000, and everybody said it was over. And I was like, no, it's not. We're going to head higher. And we kind of had that double top that occurred later in the year in November, where we went back up to $69,000 for Bitcoin and the altcoins followed suit. So we're really seeing that play out right now. And that's confirmed by the fact that Bitcoin cycles, which, you know, the Bitcoin cycle really revolves around the halving, which I've highlighted from the very beginning of the Crypto Cycle publication. And that is predicated on the halving event, which halves the mining rewards for Bitcoin and creates a supply shock and a massive surge in the price. And that tops out 80 weeks post-halving, which actually puts us in October of 2025. So we pretty much have Bitcoin hitting its all-time highs probably this summer to early fall, with altcoins following suit shortly after, which is why I've been holding everything in the portfolio, and we've been seeing a really nice bounce as crypto really picks up steam and goes higher.
So answer me this. You came back in at the perfect time. I was talking about, I was expecting Bitcoin to go to that support level as well, and I had issued a buy alert, but I never got quite to the price that I wanted to buy the Bitcoin ETF at. I was like a 20 cents or 30 cents away or something. So I was saying I missed my opportunity, but you've had readers in for a while. And I guess my question to you was going to be, why did we get this run in Bitcoin from the $70,000 handle just a month or two ago to 105 and nearly 106,000? So I understand why gold was going up to 3,500 during that time, central bank buying and things like that. But what led to that reascension of Bitcoin in this short, compacted time frame?
Yeah, so Bitcoin most of the time does follow the S&P 500 very closely, but not 100% of the time. And I think we saw a bit of a divergence during that sell-off, and we saw Bitcoin gain strength, much like it did in early 2023 when you had the bank failures. Bitcoin's role as an alternative, kind of a alternative to the centralized banking system, showed its strength then, even though the stock market was looking really weak. And we saw a little bit of that here. Even though it is still traded as a risk-on asset, I think smart money was buying the dip in anticipation of the stock market rebounding, because that was a really violent sell-off. And you and others correctly pointed out that the stock market was going to go higher later in the year. Like, this wasn't going to be the end of the bull run. So that was a big factor. Bitcoin decoupled a little bit from the stock market in the short term. And then I think most importantly, the most accurate indicator for the performance of Bitcoin, very arguably, is the global liquidity, the M2. And that spiked higher. Bitcoin generally tends to lag that by a few months. But if you pull up a chart with the Bitcoin next to the M2, I mean, it's tracking it very closely. It's just lagging a little bit behind. And that's why, one of the many reasons why I remained firm in my conviction that Bitcoin was going to hit new all-time highs this year, and why it's now up well over $100,000 from those $75,000 lows back in March.
The budget's working its way through Congress right now. They're obviously going to expand the deficit, right? They're going to give me my tax cuts that me and Gerardo have been discussing. They're talking about a salt cap. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but a state and local tax deduction, which really helps me out here in Washington, which has recently imposed a capital gains tax. And taxes have gone up in general here since I moved. So There's currently a $10,000 cap on the salt deduction that was a part of the 2017 tax bill that was passed under Trump. But now they're trying to take it up to, I mean, there's some Republicans in blue states, like Republicans from California and New York, that are clamoring for a $50,000 salt deduction. We'll probably get $30,000. But all that to say that they're still going to pass a $1 trillion defense budget. And oh, surprise, the tariffs that were supposed to cover all the income tax aren't anywhere close to doing so. And so we're going to get an expansion of the debt and an expansion of the deficit. And you know, that's what you're sort of saying there, right? You get this expansion of the money supply and the global debts. You mentioned something there about the smart money coming back in and buying up Bitcoin as it sort of had that V-shaped recovery alongside the S&P. My question to you, I think, is who is the smart money? So I had written down on our sheet that me and Gerardo threw together, I was going to ask you about Mr. Saylor and MSTR, because I saw that he was going to buy some more Bitcoin. And I've been seeing El Salvador back in the news. Even I think Conor McGregor might be going to visit the president of El Salvador, and something about establishing a Bitcoin reserve for Ireland. So that's a sort of a two-part question there. Who is the smart money in the Bitcoin space? And what do you make of these recent announcements from MicroStrategy and El Salvador?
Well, I mean, you talked about a lot of them. I mean, we increasingly have nation states exploring the adoption of Bitcoin. You've got MicroStrategy that's buying it up like crazy. You have the largest stablecoin issuer, Tether, buying it up like crazy. You have a myriad of institutions buying it up. And of course, you have all the spot traded ETFs and BlackRock, et cetera. And now you increasingly have state adoption of Bitcoin, even not only the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve, which hasn't found out revenue neutral ways to acquire Bitcoin. We'll see how they're able to do that. But you have states exploring the adoption and purchase of Bitcoin, with a lot of legislation being passed right now. Louisiana, back in September 2024, they were the first state to accept crypto for paying taxes on the state level. Colorado was even actually earlier than that. In September of 2022, they set up a crypto payment program to you could pay anything from income taxes to severance taxes, and that runs through PayPal's crypto hub. PayPal is a really good, really easy to use avenue for just buying basic Bitcoin cryptos like Bitcoin, Ethereum.
That's a good point.
Utah is another one that lets you pay income taxes, Ohio. And Wyoming might be the most crypto friendly state. They have Senator Cynthia Lummis out there who's very pro crypto, and they don't require any kind of money transmission licenses for blockchain companies. They've done a lot of development in the blockchain space. They recognize DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations, as legal entities. And they have zero state income taxes. They have crypto banks. So that's going to be a big center of growth for crypto in the United States moving forward. Another one is Texas. It's already kind of leading the way in facilitating Bitcoin miners. They have a ton of Bitcoin miners there that are using unused excess power, like the Alcoa aluminum plant north of Austin and other large industrial sites that aren't in use anymore. And they are passing the House Bill 4258, which would allow the state to invest directly into the Bitcoin ETFs. So that's huge. I think that'll probably pass. Kentucky passed House Bill 701, which offers legal protection for people who mine, run nodes, or stake crypto. It doesn't actually involve the state investing directly in digital assets, but it's very crypto-friendly at any rate, which is a big deal. And then Arizona is very close to making a big move into crypto. Their Senate passed two bills, SB 1025 and SB 1373, and those would let the state invest up to 10% of its treasury funds in Bitcoin and other high market cap cryptocurrencies, up to at least $750 billion. So they're really just waiting on the governor's signature at this point. And then earlier in the year, New Hampshire passed House Bill 302, which gives the state treasurer the green light to invest in Bitcoin ETFs. So on top of that, I think North Carolina and Alabama are also exploring similar legislation. So of course, you've got the smart money with Michael Saylor. You've got a number of companies that are buying it privately. And you've got these states that are exploring more and more how they can get Bitcoin into their treasuries, because it's a growth asset. It's a deflationary asset during inflationary times. The march of tyranny continues regardless of whether it's a Republican or Democrat. You will get a different flavor of an erosion of civil liberties and an erosion of your purchasing power through fiscal mismanagement and inflation.
Oh, you're speaking my language. March of Tyranny is one of my favorite cartoons. I was going to ask you about holding the Bitcoin on the treasury. You mentioned it there, and that was my question. These states that have allowed you to pay your bills or taxes with Bitcoin, Louisiana, I think, was the first one you mentioned there. Are they then in turn holding that Bitcoin as Bitcoin, or are they turning around and turning it into something else, dollars or whatever?
Well, as of now, they're simply holding the Bitcoin.
Oh, so, I mean, that's a bull case in itself for Bitcoin. I mean, you know, they're taking Bitcoin off the market. There's only so many that are ever going to be produced. And, you know, you read about these lost wallets and things, but if you've got states holding it in their treasury or some other type of trust, I mean, that's definitely a bullish case for Bitcoin in general, right?
Well, extremely. And as I said last time, all of this institutional adoption of Bitcoin is going to bolster the price of Bitcoin to an extent. And I don't think we'll have the extreme downward volatility for Bitcoin that we had in previous cycles. I do think altcoins will still have pretty extreme downward volatility, but Bitcoin is, you know, I think it's always going to be volatile to an extent, but I think the downside volatility will certainly lessen as the years go by and it gains more and more institutional adoption, state adoption. And as companies like MicroStrategy continue to acquire more, and BlackRock and others continue to expand their offerings, and their ETFs continue to expand and hold more and more Bitcoin.
On Arizona specifically, I thought I read that the governor vetoed those bills. I was going to ask you about it. I just heard you say they're waiting for signature. I'm not sure if what I read was accurate or if it was about the same bills that you mentioned, but. And maybe if you don't know about those Arizona bills specifically, the broader question would be, what is the opposition that Bitcoin is still facing in 2025? It seems to me that it's pretty ubiquitously adopted. I mean, you just mentioned that you could buy it on PayPal, for example. We know that Financial advisors are allocating to it more and more, you know, having a percentage of their clients' net worth in 1 or 2% Bitcoin. And so for me, it's I don't want to say a no-brainer. I don't like that term. But for me, it's a slice of the pie now, right? When you look at a pie chart of allocation, or if I'm building a portfolio for someone, as I did for Jackie, who I've mentioned many times on this podcast, who helps us, you know, maintain the house, you know, Bitcoin is a default allocation for me. Why would it not be for some folks, or why might politicians still be opposed to it?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it gets down to a pretty deep philosophy. If you look at Bitcoin as kind of freedom money, or what I like to think of it as the separation of money and state, I think it's clear to anyone who has eyes that our economy and our monetary system are not well handled. I mean, if you worked for 50 years making money from your labor, I mean, of course you had to pay a ton of money in taxes, but then during COVID, the government essentially printed away 20 years of your labor. So your only hope at that point was to have some hard assets, like even a house or crypto or stocks, anything tangible, or even digital assets, to try to protect you from the erosion of that purchasing power. Gold, of course, is the obvious one. So I think Bitcoin being the separation of money and state, Bitcoin being deflationary, Bitcoin being decentralized, I think that appeals much more to the libertarian mindset and to people who do not think the state is your friend. I'm personally not opposed to the state, but I require good governance. And it is clear that at this time, we are not getting good governance. And in lieu of that, I would very much prefer the government to keep its hands off of as much as it can, because we have the technology now to build systems that exist outside of their centralized control. We have the internet, we have blockchain. We don't need bankers managing our monetary supply and issuing trillions in fiat currency and buying mortgage-backed securities and distorting the economy in really terrible ways that harm people on the lower end of the economic scale the most. So sadly, people in the Democratic Party are more statist in general than members of the Republican Party, although I'm not a big fan of either. So the Republicans just tend to be a lot more crypto-friendly. And with Trump in the White House, we've seen that accelerate massively, and we're going to see it continue for at least the next 3-4 years. So that's positive. But yeah, it's a major divergence in philosophical outlook, for sure. Crypto represents more of a libertarian mindset, whereas fiat currency controlled by a central bank represents people who are very statist. They want state control, and they want control over your lives. They want to tax your wealth away, and they believe that they know what's best to do with your money.
I mean, the governance, in my opinion, has been horrible under both parties for the better part of two decades or more. Yeah. from the national to the state to the local level. And you and I both live in Spokane and are aware of the issues here, and I've spoken about them at length on this podcast. I want to ask you about international governments. I thought of this question while you were talking, because we hear a lot about, and speaking of, you know, misgovernance and money printing and debt, other countries are getting less comfortable holding our debt as, you know, it gets called into question whether or not we can repay it. You know, Russia, the obvious one, but China in a very big way has been diversifying its holdings of treasury bills into other things. And I'm not, again, you know, I'm not one of these death of the dollar, China's going to dump the dollar type guy, because as I was explaining last week with Gerardo, they really can't, you know, as such a large holder of U.S. treasuries, if they start dumping, then they're just going to destroy the value of their reserves, because the market's going to collapse, right? But they are slowly, methodically, in a very Chinese way, diversifying into you know, bonds from Fannie and Freddie, which are still U.S.-based assets. They're diversifying into European-backed bonds, Swiss francs and other currencies. And there's a very long Financial Times article that I was talking about on this podcast last week that went through the things China was buying, but one of them was not Bitcoin. And so I wonder, do you know of any cases outside of El Salvador, of course, where governments, international governments, are starting to hold Bitcoin on their balance sheet or have plans to?
Yeah, we're not there yet, but the implementation of the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve by the Trump administration is the first step. So that, of course, as I explained in the last my last appearance, they're going to hold the 200,000 Bitcoin that they have. They're not going to sell it like Germany did. They had 50,000, or I think it was around 50,000 Bitcoin that they sold last year for pennies on the dollar. Really stupid move. So they're going to hold that, and hopefully the long-term plan is to acquire 2 billion Bitcoin that they'll hold in that reserve. And that'll really be the first example of like a major G7 economy buying and holding Bitcoin. And I think once that happens, you're going to start seeing that spread. You're going to start seeing central banks holding it on their balance sheet. And I wouldn't be surprised if countries like Russia and China start doing it, because ever since they froze all of Russia's SWIFT deposits in Western banks at the start of the Ukraine conflict, I mean, they're not, they wised up. They're not going to hold a bunch of money in U.S. treasuries. So Russia's been adopting Bitcoin in a big way. And I do think it's only a matter of time, even though the Chinese Communist Party, speaking of the philosophical difference, I mean, that's about as statist as you can get. So they're not philosophically huge fans of Bitcoin. I mean, they banned mining in the country back in 2021. But I do wonder, given the trend and given their overall de-dollarization that's really kicked into high gear over the last 4 or 5 years, I think in response to geopolitical tensions as well as the fact that our money is not being well managed and it's being inflated away into oblivion, I do. And then, of course, the Trump tariffs aren't helping that. So with all of those factors combined, I wouldn't be surprised to see some of these Eastern countries like Russia and China, maybe their central bank starting to acquire Bitcoin in the next 5 years. And that could be a sea change for the asset. And I think things like that are going to be what drives Bitcoin to that $1 million mark eventually.
You know who else is warming up to Bitcoin? Gerardo Del Real. So he's been long opposed, and you guys recently were together, and you were showing him how to buy some Bitcoin. I wanted you to recap that scenario for us, because again, he says he's a simple guy. He sticks to his bread and butter, sticks to his knitting, and through you, of course, he has now got allocation to Bitcoin. So I guess, what do you think changed his mind? And just walk us through, your recent experience with getting Gerardo on board.
Yeah, I had a great visit with Gerardo at his home in Austin, or north of Austin. It was really nice. And I basically made the case for Bitcoin, and I showed him how to buy some. It is, if you follow the instructions in CryptoCycle, I think easier than buying stocks on Charles Schwab. It's incredibly easy to buy. And I kind of can give you the cliff notes as to how I sold him. And it really came down to kind of three key reasons to own Bitcoin. And the first one was that Bitcoin is digital gold. And like gold, Bitcoin has that finite supply. Only 21 million can ever be mined. And it operates independently from governments and wealthy elites, billionaires. It's run by code. It can't be changed. Of course, lately, major financial figures and institutions, including Larry Fink of BlackRock, and now even the U.S. Treasury with the Bitcoin Reserve, are recognizing Bitcoin as a hedge against inflation and a strategic reserve asset. And of course, since it's been well over a year now that we've had the spot Bitcoin ETFs in the United States that have been the most successful ETFs ever launched, those have further legitimized its role in finance. And maybe one of the most significant things is that unlike gold, Bitcoin can actually generate you some yield. You can get 2 to 4% or sometimes more yield through certain accounts. And I show you how to do that as well. With about four clicks of the button, you can get some yield on your Bitcoin, which is, of course, something that gold can't offer. Second big thing is Bitcoin is a growth asset. Like I said before, Bitcoin is deflationary, and it has those automatic supply reductions called the halvings, like I mentioned earlier, that historically boost its price. We all know, like I said, fiat currencies are inflationary, subject to government manipulation. They're not well handled. Bitcoin is well handled because it's computer code and it cannot be changed, and it will continue to go up in value in time because it is deflationary, because they basically figured out how to create digital scarcity. And I just don't think people realize how significant that is yet, but they will. And then Bitcoin is totally transforming finance. I think since I started this publication, Bitcoin has gone mainstream. We've got institutional investors and nation states adopting Bitcoin, and we've got legislation out the wazoo that's pro-Bitcoin, pro-crypto, and that's going to cause a lot of growth in the space in 2025 and beyond. And I mean, digital assets are just now a core part of the economy. It's not going away. With Trump in the White House, it's not going away. I do think the Democrats were going to try to kill it as best they could, but that's over now. And whether you like or hate Trump, he's totally pro-crypto, and that's probably largely due to the fact that he had so many campaign contributions from the crypto industry, and he's delivered. I mean, they've gotten their investments back in spades, just similar to Elon Musk. So yeah,
had his own coin as well for a little bit there.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? You mentioned Beyond, not in the capacity that I'm going to mention it, but there's a company called Beyond that I've been invested in for a while because it has sort of a crypto arm or a crypto investment portfolio that includes a platform called T0 that I believe is going to have value in the future. Now, you know, I'm a Bitcoin maxi and I don't own any other altcoins or anything. I have Bitcoin in my safe, which you helped me do on a hard wallet or a cold wallet. And then I own a couple of ETFs that I bought in the open market, those spot Bitcoin ETFs that you were mentioning. But I do think there's value in the blockchain and in tokenization and in transparency and other features that it offers, which is why I've been invested in Beyond for so long and continue to think it has value. And that's sort of my segue into altcoins, which I don't know a ton about, but you know, you just wrote an article on Daily Profit Cycle this week about altcoins. And I just want to get your take on the current environment for them and ask you about altcoin season, because you were writing that it was canceled, but now it's back.
Well, that's right. Yeah. It's been a little bit of a frustrating year, because Bitcoin's hit new all-time highs a couple of times, and we've seen some wild swings for altcoins, but nothing that would be considered like an altcoin season, which we usually get. We got one back in 2021, and we got one in the previous cycle 4 years before that. But I actually believe that with Bitcoin likely hitting new all-time highs this summer into the early fall, once that Bitcoin dominance drops off, we're actually going to finally see altcoin season. And that's going to be propelled largely by Ethereum, which is the preeminent altcoin, the one with the second largest market cap behind Bitcoin. And even though it had a terrible start of the year where it dipped down, I think it got as low as $1,500. It's now over $2,500. I was telling people the last time I was on to be buying it under $2,000. It is the preeminent layer one. It's the first smart contract layer one blockchain, which means that you can build applications on top of it. Smart contracts are self-executing contracts that, you know, you can essentially, theoretically, you can replace most contracts with them, and you basically cut out the middleman. So like real estate transactions, tokenization of real world assets, all of that stuff is largely built on Ethereum. And even though there's still a lot of volatility, I think Ethereum's still going to hit a new all-time high later this year. And that's what's going to drive up all the altcoins. And that's what I have heavily positioned in my $50,000 real money portfolio that you can follow. I think just about everything in there that's highlighted a buy is still a very strong buy right now, in anticipation of heading into that alt season later this year. But I think with Bitcoin being so strong with the institutional adoption, altcoins took a little bit of a backseat. And I also think the Fed obviously is not running as accommodative of a monetary policy as they were like in 2021, for example, when everything skyrocketed. It's not maybe going to be quite as easy as it was then. But that doesn't mean we aren't going to get a strong alt season. And I very much believe it's going to come this summer, and the markets will likely top out. You know, I'll be informing my readers. I have technical indicators that I'll use to inform them of exactly when I think it's topping in real time. But it'll likely be around September, October, maybe.
I might ask you for a pick or two when we get to the premium portion of this podcast in a couple of minutes. But first, I just wanted to get your take on the Trump administration for the Bizarro Banter section of this podcast, because I know you were calling for his election, you know, when the polls were saying that it was very tight. You saw clearly the reasons for his reelection. I have my own opinions, of course, but I'd like to hear what you think about, you know, Trump's first couple of months in office, your take on the tariff back and forth, and frankly, if you think he's doing a good job.
Oh, boy. Well, I'll bring back the March of Tyranny reference again. So, you know, with Trump, the only thing I was excited about with a Trump win, I did not vote for Trump. I had a lot of concerns, but I was excited about all of the pro-crypto legislation, most of which has happened. And that's great for the industry. That's great for the libertarian ideals of Bitcoin and the separation of money from state and individual empowerment, all things that I believe in quite strongly. I think he's, you know, obviously going to have better tax policy than anything the Democrats were talking about. I am not a fan of the way that ICE is rounding people up, but I don't think that the Biden administration's immigration policy was in any way sustainable or workable in any way, shape, or form. So something had to be done about that. But I am skeptical about a lot of things. I was not thrilled about the fact that the first thing Trump did right before the inauguration was launch a meme coin, basically enriching insiders who knew about it beforehand or on the first hour of launch, getting everybody to buy in and then basically liquidating them because it was something like 70 to 80% of the people who bought into that coin lost money, which is why I didn't buy into it. I didn't recommend my readers to buy into it, because if it was something like that, if you don't get it in the first hour, it's not worth touching. And not only is that unethical in practice, it opens up the possibility for it being used to curry favor with the administration. You could, buy $50 million of Trump coin and you get a seat at his special dinner and you get the ear of the president.
You could just give him a jet.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a way to kind of get around that. And I think it's unethical. But this doesn't surprise me. I mean, Trump has always been a bit of a grifter, and the Trump family has always been involved in a lot of things that are not totally above board. I think the Epstein client list release was a total farce. I don't really know what that was. It was much hyped. People wanted to know who's on that list, but I don't think Trump's ever going to put that list out because there are simply too many powerful and connected people on it, and it will never see the light of day. And then I guess I'm a little bit intrigued and a little bit encouraged by his Middle Eastern trip that he's doing right now, because my assumption was that given how much money he gets from the Israel lobby, that he was just going to give Netanyahu anything he wanted. And it seems like he's at least pushing back a little bit and being a little bit independent and not green lighting the mass murder of another tens of thousands of civilians in Gaza, and not bombing Iran, potentially triggering World War III, which would be disastrous for the United States. I think those are two things Netanyahu wants. And I'm very glad to see Trump at least push back a little bit on that, because that would be very damaging to the world and to are standing in the global scene.
Yeah, that's a very nuanced take, man. That's why I like talking to you. I have very similar sentiments. I would add that, you know, he's really hard to gauge, right? He's obviously back and forth. There's been lots of jokes about 3D chess, 4D chess, you know, all that sort of stuff, right? You never really know what he's going to do. But at the end of the day, he seems to come down more in the center, which is something I like, right? Like,
yeah.
I'm thinking, I'll say Ukraine as an example, right? We had that moment a couple of months ago in the White House where Zelensky came over and Vance, you know, blew up at him. I think that was probably a staged moment. But here we are a couple of months later, and he's being, I think, more stiff with Putin and working towards an actual ceasefire. So you never know where he's going to end up. And it seems like I don't think it's a master negotiation tactic, or maybe it is, but it seems like he ends up somewhere in the middle. He plays both sides a little bit, and then he ends up somewhere in the middle, which is something I actually like about him. I'm definitely a middle type of guy. So anything else on Mr. Trump before we move to the paid portion of this podcast?
Well, just the tariff, whatever that tariff fiasco was. I don't know where exactly they got those calculations, but that was absolutely absurd and was going to have no other result but to cause mass panic in the markets and the economy. I am not even against the spirit of the tariffs. I think it's been a terrible disservice to our society to offshore all the manufacturing and NAFTA that was signed in 1992 by Clinton. All of these things greatly harmed average Americans, especially Americans in the middle of the country. I mean, I have deep Midwestern roots, and so many people who had decent, honest, honorable work that they could provide for a family with, building real things, doing real work. So many of those people lost their means of providing for their family and having a dignified way to make a living. So I think tariffs done in a reciprocal and targeted way, implemented over time to bring back certain industries, is needed. But whatever that Liberation Day was a sledgehammer to global trade, and just does not make Trump or his advisors like Navarro and Lutnick appear to be very intelligent economists, regardless of their education.
Certainly been a hollowing out of the middle class. You and I are from the East Coast. I'm from Baltimore. I believe there's 30,000 boarded up homes in that city. You know, the yeah. steel plant leaves or closes, and the people and the jobs go with it. But a broader point, at least for me, is, and like you say, you're not opposed to the sentiment of the tariffs. You know, America needs a reindustrialization. We were all too content to outsource those jobs. And for me, almost more importantly, to outsource that production and the specialization and I'm going to get to the resources, obviously, the resource extraction and purification. And so you end up at this point where not only have the jobs and the manufacturing gone away, but we don't have the expertise anymore. Even if we wanted to reindustrialize, there's a very long learning curve that's going to go back with that, to getting machinists and engineers to a point where
it'll take decades to do. It's not going to happen overnight like Trump seems to think it will.
Correct. The same with the minerals, right? I mean, in some cases, we're 80-90% reliant on not just the mining, but the purification of these things on China. So he's making some of the right moves. You know, he's fast-tracked the permitting of some mines, including those companies we're involved in, like Perpetua. This week, he fast-tracked a uranium mine in the American Southwest. And so he's starting to say the right things and do some of the right things, but I concur, it's going to take much longer than he and many other people realize. I think that's it for the free portion of this podcast. I'm going to migrate over to the premium picks portion. We'll look forward to getting Gerardo back next week. Congratulations to him and his family on graduating of college from his middle son, which is, I believe, the first in Gerardo's family to get a college degree. They had like a special ceremony at the university for first of generation graduates, which Gerardo was going to attend. So congrats to the Del Real family for sure. And that's it for me. This was episode 317 of Investing in Bizarre World. On behalf of my partner, Gerardo, and Mr. Chris Curl here, I'm Nick Hodge, and we'll catch you again next week.